It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
I think please. I'll try defying gravity.
Okay, I'm really against buskers having amps. And I know that's probably controversial. But I'm like, if you have an amp in a subway station, please God, stop. This girl had an amp and she was like singing Defying Gravity. It was
good for
honestly
her.
Amazing. Like walking into the station and hearing,
I think I'll try defying gravity
with like full music theater voice.
You were like, damn, I'm in New York. This is a real New York moment. Broadway.
Damn. Yeah. I filmed myself being like, hey guys, just feeling so blessed right now. Anyways, I just woke up. Hannah dragged my ass out of bed to deliver to you guys this episode.
This is so hard for us. We're on a 6-hour time difference, and I've never felt more distant from my wife.
No, my wife. Yeah, if you want to know how hard this is for us, our nomadic lifestyles, we already recorded the beginning of this episode and had to stop because the Wi-Fi was so bad. Where either I was or Hannah was, and it's likely where Hannah was.
I think it's where I was. I was in a Paris Airbnb, and our Wi-Fi was really bad. And so we tried to record, and it just didn't work out. But I think that that's what the universe wanted. They wanted it to be here and now. This is the moment. This is the real deal.
This is the moment. This is the real deal. Fate. They did rudely interrupt me talking about how I had spent the night before we were recording crying about Jeff Buckley dying, even though, you know, he died 27 years ago. But I was really down bad that night, and I was like, here's something I can cry about. And yeah, and I wish he'd just come back, you know? Me and all his other little fans, we all wish he'd come back.
You should hold a seance.
Oh my God. Sounds wrong.
Have you? No.
Hannah and I, in the earliest days of our friendship back in high school, used a Ouija board.
And it disappeared. That Ouija board we bought my friend for her 16th birthday. Shout out Alexa. It was like a glow-in-the-dark Ouija board we bought online. And we had all so many crazy memories with that Ouija board. And none of our like Catholic-raised mothers would let us keep it in the house. Like, we had to eventually keep it in Alexa's locker at school. And then I think our friend Kat inherited it at some point. And then it disappeared from her house.
That was
so
spooky.
Cuckoo crazy. I'm sure it just ended up in a box, but like, to me, I'm like, wow, the spirits that be at Hasbro didn't want us to have such a powerful tool.
I was gonna give that shout, owned by Hasbro. Yeah, I guess I could call Jeff Buckley back in that way. I'm just like, you can't be that good looking, so talented, have an insane origin story, and then also mysteriously die.
It's just like
time.
A man to do that. Classic.
Ugh, I think he may have been the only good man.
Last night, my mom was just telling me about how nice she thinks my dad is, and I started to cry. So, yeah. And he is. No. He's the best. Yeah.
He really is the best. Also, shout out to Patrick.
Maya just told me that she wished that she... Because I'm currently in Spain with my mom, and Maya said she had FOMO. That she wanted to be in Spain. Not with me, but with me and my mom.
Yeah, I love her mom, and I don't think that's weird at all. Hannah's parents bring me so much comfort and joy. I love being around them. I wish they still had their house, because I miss that house, too. That's my comfort house.
Defying gravity. We can't see Wicked in Europe yet, I don't think.
Really?
Maybe when I go to Ireland, maybe it's out there, but it wasn't out in Paris, because I wanted to go see it so I could talk about it. It's so funny. At first, I was like, I'm not going to go see that. And now I'm like, no, I do need to know what's happening.
I've heard, like, strangely good things, but, like, all I've seen of it is just the most hideous imagery. Like, it just looks so ugly in a way that it feels unforgivable.
I hear Ariana's really good in it, and I kind of feel like if the performances are compelling enough and, like, the, you know, the songs are fun, like, I think it, even if it looks kind of dumb, it could still be a good time. So I'm intrigued.
I know. I want to see it. It's just, like, insane that it's 2.5 hours. Like, that is absolutely insane. And I think it's only Wicked Part 1.
It is, yeah.
That's insane. It is not that long of a story. Like, that is, this is, yeah. Oh, there's just so many things going against it for me that I'm like, I'm struggling. But I will go see it this week and I will be open-minded. Because I just saw the musical. I was a huge fan of the musical growing up. Like, it's not like I'm a hater. I just, everything about this is kind of batting in the opposite direction. But you know what?
We'll Sounds see. Like you are a hater.
You guys will find out our opinions at some point. So we could be very right or we could be very wrong.
I hear it's a very popular movie.
I might yet.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about internet subcultures, the stories of how they arrived, thrived, and sometimes died. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps a lot. This episode is about a subculture that is very dear to me. I was going to make you guess, but the episode title is on Spotify, and also you know what episode this is. It's about emos. Emo, for those of you who don't know, and I don't know how you couldn't, is an abbreviation of emotional, and it was used to define a youth subculture that became pretty ubiquitous in the mid-2000s, and just a warning up front, we're going to be touching a bit on the topic of suicide and self-harm, so if that's something particularly sensitive to you, feel free to skip this episode. Like many other millennials and Zoomers, I was an active participant of emo-dom when I was in middle school from around 2008 to 2010. I wasn't really old enough to go full throttle with it like a lot of teenagers were at the time, but, you know, I was into, like, the skinny jeans and suspenders, and, like, I had, like, fingerless lace gloves and, like, checkered shirts, I don't know. My mom also let me get these, like, Braden colorful highlights at one point, and in grade 8, I got this, like, scene haircut. I don't know if you... Do you remember what the scene haircut looked like?
Of course. It was just, like, the heaviest side bangs, I guess you could imagine, and, like, very interesting layers is how I would describe it.
It's super top heavy, really short layers on the top, kind of spiked up, and then, like, really long kind of, like, rat tails down below, like, really long extensions. Mm-hmm. I got a scene haircut, but, like, I was a kid, did not know how to style my hair, so I just kind of, like, left it as it is, and I have really straight hair, so it was just kind of, like, limp all the time, so I just had literal tiny layers up here all over the top of my head, and I thought it looked good, too. Like, I wasn't fazed at all. I also dabbled a lot in, like, eyeliners and eyeshadows. I was sharing all those, like, early memes. Like, you know, it'd be, like, this, like, little bandaged cartoon character. And it'd be, like, can I has a cookie? Very you core, actually, Hannah. Anytime I'm eating any sort of food, Hannah comes up and she's, like, can I has one?
Wait, what did I text you that one night? I was, like, going home. No, I think I'd just gotten home from a party and my year was still out. She'd made lemon squares for her cousin or something. I texted her, can I has a lemon square?
I mean, so adorable.
I mean, I'm just so quirky. I can't believe I'm telling this anecdote about myself.
You would fit but right in with the emos.
Here's the thing. I learned about can I has a cheeseburger really late. And then when I did learn about it, I thought it was so funny.
Well, I went back because I don't think that this meme I'm talking about said, can I has a cookie? But I went back to my Facebook to try and find the meme. Like, it was like this one specific meme that was like my profile picture for a while, and I can't find it. But yeah, I was also a diehard fan of My Chemical Romance, who we'll be talking about in this episode. I was obsessed with these guys, Destry and Nate, on YouTube. Their YouTube name was Des and Nate. I'm going to link them in the description because you guys need to see. But they were these kind of like random core, like scene guys. I was also obsessed with Nate's girlfriend who also had a YouTube channel. Her name was Lita Bear. Shout out. I don't know if anyone remembers her, but I thought she was the most beautiful girl in the entire whole wide world. She just like was very seen, like had big hair. She was like really pretty and she had crazy eyeshadow and she'd do all these like makeup tutorials. And I still think it's awesome. I went back to her YouTube channel. She deleted her channel, but I went back through all her like archived videos and I don't know, it brought up the nostalgia in me.
Aww.
And just to differentiate, scene is not the same as emo. It kind of came out of emo, but it's a bit more positive, like a bit more optimistic, kind of overlapped with rave culture and a lot more colorful and like very focused on like being random. But it's an extension of emo, like there is overlap between them.
I feel like scene is very much rooted in like 2008 and around that time. Whereas like I remember using the word emo as children.
Yeah. Emo so, came around yeah. before scene.
Feels a bit more abstracted. But as a kid, I was always confusing emo and goth, I feel like.
Oh, yeah. And I'll talk about the difference yeah. between them.
I can't wait.
All very arbitrary differences, but like, you know, as this entire podcast is arbitrary.
Hey.
But enough about me. Hannah, what was your relationship to emo culture at the time? Were there any emo kids at your school? Like, did you listen to any emo music? Talk about it.
I remember once when all my friends that I had in the States and I all got Gmail and we used to chat on Gmail and email each other a lot. I remember my friend sending me a Paramore song and that was the only Paramore song I knew for most of my life. And I really liked it. And then there was one Fall Out Boy song that was on this karaoke video game I had, and that was the only Fall Out Boy song I knew.
What song was it?
One night, yeah, one night. Thanks for the memories.
I feel like there's gonna be a lot of this. So yeah. Strap in, guys.
Strap in. But that's the closest I ever got to being emo or scene. It's weird because I was such an Avril Lavigne diehard fan as a kid, and you would think that the pipeline from Avril Lavigne to Paramore would be a pretty clear one. And yet, at the peak of emo, I was like very much a Taylor Swift girly. I was very much listening to like musical soundtracks. I was top 40 boots the house down.
A normie?
Yeah. Okay, when I was a kid, my idols were the girls on TV shows that looked goth. Like every TV show, there'd be this one female friend who like had streaks in her hair and was like kind of gothy looking. And that was who I wanted to be when I grew up. But as far as like emo culture, I kind of just missed the boat with that. And I feel like retroactively, there were kids around me that had those scene haircuts. Like, I mean, I had hideous side bangs, but that's because I saw Vanessa Hudgens have them and I also didn't know how to style them. And I had red highlights, but that was not related to anything. I wanted to be artsy looking, but I also really wanted to be accepted. Like, I went to a very basic school. But I did wear colored skinny jeans from Urban Planet. But that was, again, because I was reading, like, 17 magazine.
But as much as you might like to think that there's no relation between emo and what you were doing, there actually is a lot of relation, which we will get into in this episode.
This is sounding like the beginning of the Devil Wears Prada monologue again.
Cerulean. I think it's good for us to discuss what exactly emos were, obviously, because I think it's something that's been hotly debated for years now. I don't think we're ever going to encompass it fully because I think a major part of being emo is telling other people that you've got them wrong, like you've got it wrong. That's not emo, this is emo. But let's try it. What are the general signifiers of an emo person?
The previously established scene haircut. I'd say like the thick eyeliner underneath, guy liner. I think some good solid facial piercings, you know, a lip piercing, an eyebrow piercing, a Monroe piercing. Oh, snake bites.
Very big that. Snake bites. Yeah.
Yeah. My alternative middle school, I think there were definitely some kids that had some remnants of emo style, but they were listening to like EDM or something. So I don't really know.
So Scene.
Oh, was Scene, they listened to EDM in Scene?
Like rave culture, yeah. Scene was rave. They like ukulele music, but they also liked kind of like EDM fast.
Can I be so real? I learned what Scene was in grade 11. I had a friend who was referencing her Scene phase, and I was like, what is that?
That's crazy.
I know.
Guess if you knew, you knew, you know?
It's actually one of the weirdest things to me that I literally missed such a big cultural moment. I feel like I had my fingers on the pulse.
Yeah, girl. I mean, yeah, but then there's alt culture and then there's mainstream culture. And I guess, you know, you've got it down pat. The hair, the piercing, snake bites especially, huge. And I want to bring them back because they're cool. I thought they were so hot at the time. Spiky kind of glossed hair. I'd say that specific Scene haircut kind of came a bit later. But like, yeah, definitely spiky, like deep side part kind of hair. There was a lot of an emphasis on like paleness and thinness, which unfortunately were big aspects of this community, which not great. For clothing, there was a lot borrowed from the goth subculture, but with a bit more of like a pop element. You still have like the lace and the dark colors, but I think less of a use of like leather and an introduction of black and white stripes and like a lot of reds, checker, like black and white checkers. There are a lot of similarities between goths and emos, but if you really want like a brief differentiation between them, I've heard people say that goth is more of an externalization of sadness and like angst, more of a celebration of darkness. It has its roots in, of course, like the gothic movement of the 19th century, whereas emo is more of an internalization of these things, like a lot more of a focus on the darkness of the self. Being sad is kind of the greatest signifier of emo-ness. Also, goths came around way before emos, like they kind of popped up in the 70s.
That's what I was gonna ask, because I feel like I'm like, goths are like an 80s thing originally or something.
The goths were around first for sure, yeah. But there's overlap and emos definitely share a lot of similarities with them. Hannah also, to ask that question, put her hand up like she was in class.
Because I didn't want to interrupt. So we're recording, because we're not in the same room. I'm like, I don't know if there's like a slight delay, so I don't want to like think that there's a pause in your thing.
No, and you know, a good podcast editor would just simply separate our audios so that we don't interrupt each other, but here I am just editing them right on top of each other. They're just layered. And
she's a busy girl.
And what do you find characterizes emo music?
This is my question, is I always, I guess, considered emo music to be pop punk. But then I feel like there's also like that weird kind of like, I'm a guy on my guitar and I'm singing like this on my ukulele. And I don't know what that is.
I'm in trouble. I'm
yeah, that shit.
I'm addicted to this girl. She's got my heart tied in a knot and my stomach in a whirl.
What is that song? I know what
it's
it
never
is,
showed ever.
Right. True. What, okay, Fedora's so emo?
So that's Scene. Like, I would say Never Showed Never is more of the Scene category. Again, more optimistic, very like Sweetie Pie music. That would not be emo music. You're close though. I feel like pop punk is definitely associated with emo, and we'll learn why. But yeah, usually it has quite solemn or like nihilistic, kind of cynical lyrics. They're often about heartbreak. Yes.
Is Linkin Park emo? What is that?
No, I would not say Linkin Park.
What emo is Linkin Park?
Rock, like alt rock. I don't think they ever got emo attached to them. Although, you know, like I think Numb would definitely have similarities tone-wise and lyric-wise, but I feel like Linkin Park would be extremely offended if they ever were called that. But anyways, yeah, emo music tends to have like an up-tempo beat, like very fast guitar strumming. They tend to be kind of not operatic, but there would often be like an anthem-like line that you could chant along to. The singer would stretch their vowels a lot, like you were just demonstrating. Sometimes they do screamo. Generally, it's just defined by its angstiness. So if we think emo as coming out of a musical genre, then its origins can be found back in the 80s in the punk scenes of DC and Detroit and San Francisco. And within these scenes, the term emo was used more as a pejorative for hardcore punk bands that were making kind of like emotional introspective songs. So examples of early emo bands from this time are Rites of Spring from DC, or Moss Icon in Baltimore, or Jawbreaker in California. And yeah, the lyrics are often quite somber, a little bit self-loathing, kind of sad about the world. Hannah, do you want to read just a few lines from one of Rites of Spring's most famous songs. The song is called For Want Of, but I want to give the people a taste.
I believed memory might mirror no reflections on me. I believed that in forgetting I might set myself free. But I woke up this morning with a piece of past caught in my throat, and then I choked. I bled. I tried to hide the heart from the head. And I said, I bled in the arms of a girl I'd barely met. But I woke up this morning with the present in splinters on the ground. And then I drowned. And if I can't see, it's for want of you.
Very kind of diaristic, like vulnerable lyrics, especially for such a masculine genre like hardcore. Like these guys were in punk bands. I think Rites of Spring is great. Jawbreaker has a bit more of a social leaning. Their songs explore a lot of themes of like the urban white working class. But in this one book that I read called Nothing Feels Good, Punk Rock, Teenagers, and Emo, Andy Greenwald talks about how both Rites of Spring and Jawbreaker's frontmen played a really big role in garnering fans and like garnering attention for the bands. He says, bands like Rites of Spring had attracted listeners because of Guy Picciotto's skill as a representative mouthpiece for the thoughts and fears of the audience. Jawbreaker, with its dominant voice and searingly personal POV, produced Emo's first idol. Blake Schwarzenbach was handsome in an unassuming way, but that wasn't the point. His appeal was his publicly private torment. There was a bitterness and frustration in his lyrics that was both universal and magnetic. But again, emo was pejorative. So from its earliest days, musicians from these bands were distancing themselves from it. Like Ian McKay, who's from this band called Minor Threat, who's considered one of the fathers of hardcore music, said in this Thrasher interview back in the day that he thought emo was the stupidest fucking thing he'd ever heard of. It's a little bit of a predecessor to like hipsterdom, like how no one wants to be called a hipster, but they're hipsters, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like Spider-Man meme, like everyone's like, I'm not this. But in this case, these guys felt like the word emo was kind of diminutive of their music, which I think is really fair. But the 80s are still seen as like the first wave of emo. Then the 90s are the second wave. There's like many waves, but there's kind of like three distinct ones. The 90s are the second wave. There's this record label called Deep Elm Records, which came out with this compilation album called Emo Diaries, which featured a bunch of songs from bands that they had signed that they claimed had possessed, quote, the ability to stir emotion like no other. During this time, the music moved a bit away from the DIY, scruffier nature of hardcore and became a bit more polished. Among some of the bands from this time were The Promise Ring, Joan of Arc, Not a Surf, and Sunny Day Real Estate. Again, most of these bands would not call themselves emo, but they had been described as such. And there was some overlapping during this time with like other genres like math rock or screamo.
What's math rock?
So cool. It's just like really intricate rock, basically, like really technically proficient, wow. Really complicated musical rock. So like American Football would be like an example of one great band. But yeah, very complicated sounds, essentially.
Oh, that's such a fun name, Matt.
I know, I think it's so cool. I watched School of Rock all the way through for this episode because I was just really listening to a lot of rock music when I was researching for this episode.
School of Rock. So School of Rock.
Yeah, and then I watched School of Rock.
It's an epic movie.
It's great. Yeah, and I was just really re-listening to a lot of emo from the day. Aww. And also getting into Rites of Spring and Jawbreaker. So good. But the 2000s is when emo really blew up. This is when a distinctive aesthetic started to come through, like the guyliner and the skinny jeans and the spiky hair. The singing started to get a bit whinier in tone. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just like a fact. The melodies started to get a bit more poppy, a little bit more optimized for radio. Groups like Jimmy Eat World and Save the Day were really embodying this. But there were three bands that really skyrocketed during this time who have been dubbed the emo trinity. Do you want to take a stab at who those three bands are?
My Chemical Romance.
Yes.
Fall Out Boy?
Mm-hmm.
And what's their faces, those guys? Oh, Panic at the Disco.
Exactly. These were the guys that were really crossing over into mainstream success, like full-blown radio hits. You really couldn't go to the mall without hearing them in, like, every store, especially Fall Out Boy. Everywhere.
Especially if Halsey was there.
Especially if Halsey. If you see Halsey, you know what's coming.
You guys know that video. Wait, whose song is that she's singing in that video?
I'm literally looking it up. Blink-182, different.
Oh, okay. And so that's the other thing is I grew up with Blink-182. Sum 41 and like Avril and like Simple Plan and like these bands that were also like radio bands that like, okay, Simple Plan is not really the same thing, but like Blink-182 we listened to a lot of in my house, and it feels like a predecessor to a lot of this stuff because that's pop punk. Adam's Song, I think the first time I ever felt depression as a kid was like for some reason when my brother played Adam's Song by Blink-182, and that was like, I was like, this is a different kind of sadness I'm feeling and I don't understand it.
So they're not like considered emo.
They're like pop punk.
Like pop punk, alt rock kind of vibes. I think because they're a little bit less morose, like they have a bit more of a wide range of topics that they cover. So it's in this 2000s era, like the third wave, that people say emo went from being a musical genre or pejorative term, whichever side you're looking at it from, to an all-out subculture. What do you think was happening during this time in the early 2000s that would make emo become a lifestyle for people as opposed to just music that they listen to?
MySpace.
But of course.
Yeah,
it's been said quite a bit that emo is distinct from other teen subcultures because it was the first of these movements to be created on the internet. You can debate that if you want, but it's undeniable that emo was one of the strongest subcultural contingents on social networking back in the 2000s. Like, MySpace was literally referred to as emo space. MySpace and LiveJournal were the primary sites that emos were using. MySpace especially had these like early customizing features that allowed people to kind of like, you know, pimp out their profiles, which really emphasized that kind of like individual expression thing that's obviously really alluring to artsy kids. It also had groups for like shared interests. It had like and dislike sections, friendship options. You could do like customizable lists. Just really a predecessor for all the social media that was going to be coming later. And these sites also had a lot of instructional discourse about how to be emo. On LiveJournal, there were already very early fan communities for My Chemical Romance and Fall Out Boy. There was one account called Fall Out Boy Love that was created 5 months before Fall Out Boy had ever released their first album. It's really just kind of this unprecedented dynamic where culture kind of emerges before the cultural object, which is just something that the internet does. And I think that's why it's unprecedented. On one side, a lot of these communities were created from the ground up, but in other ways, it was kind of a top-down thing as well, or at least like a symbiotic thing. Like, one of the articles I was reading argues that emo music fans were kind of a product of really smart marketeering. For example, My Chemical Romance kind of rose up on local New Jersey message boarding sites as well as LiveJournal, and a lot of music historians speculate that their rise was kind of meteoric because it was facilitated by the internet. These sites were like really good for bands because you can upload an entire EP onto there, which is crazy. And it was super cost effective to do so. So you could like basically update people directly about upcoming releases. You get the album up there. You're generating hype. So you could basically get famous online before ever even playing a live show or like leaving your hometown. My Chemical Romance has this like anecdote about their first gig away from home. I think they were opening for Jimmy Eat World, and they were just like stunned because thousands of people in the audience were there specifically for them, which is crazy. The craziest part was that it was really common for band members to accept fans as friends on MySpace and LiveJournal, and were often like engaging with them directly. I was kind of wondering, do you think emo in a way may have shaped or even originated online fandom today? Like, just in terms of the way it collapsed boundaries.
I think it sounds like less so that it shaped it, but that it was maybe the test run for it. I think if you look at a lot of artists who today have much stricter boundaries and, like, thicker lines between them and their fans online, 10 years ago, it was a lot looser. You would see Ariana Grande interacting with tweets, like, we've talked about Taylor Swift and her fans on Tumblr, like, how she would follow them and interact with them. And I think that it's taken time for people to realize just how destructive that kind of proximity can be. But I think, especially if you're an up-and-coming band, like, it bodes well to build that kind of, like, symbiotic relationship with your fans. I'd say they were probably the first to kind of experiment with how they could develop these fan bases with this new technology, and so probably did some things that, like, now you wouldn't necessarily see an artist do, which is, like, having those relationships.
Yeah, ramping up the parasociality of it, I think, is a huge thing. Yeah. It's probably time to come out now and say that when I was in middle school, I did not have MySpace. Instead, my most frequented website was Stardoll.com, which is a paper doll dress-up website.
And so epic.
For a very long time, I thought that I was in an online relationship with Gerard Way because I was, like, private messaging someone on Stardoll.com who said that they were Gerard Way. And I was like, this is just my little secret. Looking back, I think my friends were catfishing me because they, like, did that a lot.
Do we have proof that it wasn't Gerard Way?
I'm just saying, like, I don't know. Maybe Gerard Way used Stardoll.com and had a superstar account. $5 a month.
I think probably because these guys seem to be really good at, like, online kind of self-promotion. So it just seems, like, inevitable. I think actually, like, the odds are in your favor that you were dating Gerard Way and you should make that more public.
I'm going to come out with that.
Yeah.
You heard it here now. I dated Gerard Way when I was 12.
People magazine, podcaster says she dated Gerard Way when she was 12.
Oh, I love Gerard Way.
I was friends with Robert Pattinson on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. There were always these, like, fake Facebook accounts. I remember when Justin Bieber, when I was, like, kind of near the end of middle school, there was all these rumors that Justin Bieber was going to go to the arts high school that Hannah and I went to, which actually maybe could have been true, except that he was 2 years older than us. So I don't know. Maybe I've talked about this on here. Anyways, but there was a lot of rumor that he was, like, auditioning the same year we were. And then I remember one of the boys that I was friends with in middle school was like, I found Justin Bieber's secret Facebook account. His name's Alex on Facebook. You have to add him right now. And, like, I got the plug and I like friended Alex and I was like, oh, I'm friends with Justin Bieber, but I certainly was fake. Obviously.
It was just a guy named Alex.
No. Like, I think it was a fake Justin Bieber profile.
Love it.
That called itself Alex, but yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there is always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema streaming anytime, anywhere. Streaming on Mubi in North America starting December 23rd is Andrea Arnold's portrait of working-class life in Britain, Bird. After 12-year-old Bailey learns her father, played by Barry Keoghan, is getting married, she meets a mysterious, lithe man named Bird, played by Passages' Franz Wigowski. Bird is a fable about the struggle to preserve innocence and childlike wonder in a world where children are forced to grow up too fast, led by a breakthrough performance by newcomer Nikaya Adams. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/rehash. That's mubi.com/rehash for a whole month of great cinema for free.
But yeah, I think the element of being able to interact with these guys that you idolized or, like, crushed on definitely formed that parasocial bond that would inevitably take these bands out of their niches and, like, alternative spaces and into more mainstream ones just because of the fandom of it. Because now there's, like, hype generating around them. There's this, like, desire for proximity that you can kind of see for yourself on the sites. There's this really great book about alt rock and major record labels by Dan Oatsy, where he says, MySpace's rising popularity among teens raised on webcams and dial-up modems blurred the line between the underground and the mainstream. Which, yes. I think also the fact that these weren't dedicated sites for the bands maybe also had a play because they had like more general functions as well. So that being like an emo music fan kind of trickled into more lifestyle territory as well. You're integrating it as a part of your life by having these bands be a part of your profile, like your personal profile, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you were, well, yeah, it's like curating your like online presentation of yourself.
Persona. Social networking sites like MySpace or LiveJournal have been referred to as micromedia. So kind of offshoots, I keep saying mainstream, but they're kind of offshoots of mass media that have broken off and like serve smaller groups of the population. And micromedia allows people to be like the producers of their own media rather than the consumers of it, the internet. And it just made me think a lot about whether internet subcultures and even subcultures historically are kind of a form of self-governance for young people. What do you think of that idea?
Ooh, could you explain a little further?
Yeah, I think similar to like our Furries episode, I think emo kind of spoke to something in people who felt marginalized. Again, kind of like an extension of goth, like kids who felt ridiculed or alienated. And so the internet provides this like safe place for them to convene with each other. And I think especially if you're living in a suburb, it's a lot harder to access community, right? So like by virtue of just how separated and immobile young people in the suburbs tend to be, so the internet can kind of connect them with kids from other suburbs, other countries, urban areas. And like with the ability to produce your own micromedia, you can kind of self-direct and like direct other people about how to engage in a certain culture. Like again, with the instructional, like how to be emo stuff, a lot of these fan groups are like self-regulating. I kind of like to think that it gives young people who, like, I think in North America are especially disenfranchised a little bit of power, maybe even some, like, mobility. So, I don't know, I think it just allows them to, like, represent themselves, which adds to this, like, aesthetic dimension of emo-dom.
Well, no, but I also wonder if it allows people who themselves, like, feel that they are outcasted by groups sort of get to feel or like have that same kind of power just in their own domain, right? You're like, I feel like I don't fit the mold that was set whatever by this, like the mainstream groups. So I'm creating my own mold and like in that way, kind of getting to exert that power over other people or getting to kind of feel like there's exclusivity in what I'm doing instead of just sort of feeling like outcasted.
Yeah, I think that's kind of how the idea of community can so quickly trickle into just being gatekeepy, for example, because people just enjoy the power of being in the in-group. So I think definitely
sometimes alt kids are the meanest ones, I'll say it.
But of course, as we've said many times before, the meanest girls at our school were the punk girls. That was just the case. But yeah, I think it's just interesting that it's like these communities are completely regulated by often underage people. And I think that that's really fascinating and kind of cool. But obviously that comes with its own problems. But I also think it's really interesting that they're these little tiny like kingdoms.
I feel like a lot of music based subcultures are, well, almost all of them are predominantly young people throughout history. Because those are the people that are also going to be congregating in the spaces where that music is like consumed and enjoyed. They're usually the people that are performing in the band are like young enough, or so people who are, you know, just younger or the same age as. Yeah, it is a very interesting thing that I think when you feel like you don't have a fuller sense of like belonging or purpose because you're young and you're not like, you don't have a job, you don't have a family, you don't have these other responsibilities, that you like find yourself then revolving your life around something. And something I find so interesting about fandom is that like you might start off being sort of, you know, like you enjoy something, but it's not like you're obsessed with it, but just by being around people who share that interest, it only like elevates it. And that's when it becomes a communal thing, like a shared almost like cultural thing. And I think that would be more likely to happen with young people because their energy isn't placed elsewhere.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's like they can put their entire intention into belonging basically and like membership because they have time.
Yeah.
If they got one thing, it's time.
Well, also, you're like, I don't know who I am. So if all my friends are like, well, we're seen and we're doing our hair this way, then I can go, oh, perfect. So same. I so like the same. Song. Same. Okay, well, yeah, we'll all go to this store in the mall and we'll all do that. And That's great, because I actually don't know who I am, and I don't know how to really start in figuring that out.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful kind of like mutual direction, self-direction for kids. Obviously, that can go south very quickly, but I think it's interesting. People cite the mass exodus from MySpace to Facebook in the late 2000s as kind of the beginning of the end for emo culture, mainly because Facebook wasn't as optimal for music groups. You know, can't post your whole EP on there. And then in 2006, there were these two Australian teens, Jodie Gaither and Stephanie Gestier, who committed suicide together in a national park. And when it was discovered that both girls were avid MySpace users and self-identified as emo, and also that someone had left a message on the website for their all-girl band that said RIP Jodie and Steph before they had even gone missing, it sparked like an all-out moral panic. Do you remember any of the emo kids you knew at the time wearing those cut-off sleeves?
No, but I know, I remember that as an aesthetic.
Like, yeah, I do know what that is. Having these kind of detached sleeves that you could wear.
Again, like, I just really didn't have that much exposure to real emos.
And you went to an alternative middle school.
Well, only for grade 8, and that was when it was sort of dwindling out.
Interesting.
So I don't think you would have seen proper emos at my other schools.
I went to the most basic middle school of all time, and there were quite a few at mine. But
I wonder if proximity to the suburbs increases the likelihood of emos.
Maybe. Yeah, a major and really, like, unfortunate aspect of emo culture was a very open glorification of self-harm. Mm. I remember there was this guy in my middle school who, like, he was a chill guy. He was a good student. A lot of people thought he was a musical prodigy. Like, I remember people being like, ah, he has perfect pitch. But at one point, he started wearing, like, the cut-off sleeves and started, like, posting a lot about cutting. I think, like, a popular one he shared was this kind of, like, cartoon of these two roads. And the text on it was like, remember, kids, it's down the road, not across the street, which I will not explain further. But one of the studies I was reading also, you know, went into these emo forums and found that these types of sentiments were pretty pervasive within them. I think because emo was about being sad, one of the requirements for membership was kind of like proving to others how depressed you were, which of course leads to some pretty self-destructive behaviors. And again, like, you know, a lot of emo music, it's kind of nihilistic, which could maybe emphasize those feelings of futility, especially among, you know, hormonal people. You know, because in a way you're finding your community, but if your community is all about like interiority and like being sad, then it could also be kind of lonely in a way to be a part of a community where everyone, that's their whole MO.
Well, yeah, people aren't necessarily going to be like, hey, I'm having a bad day. Hey, friends, want to help me out of it? It's not really.
Well, because the whole thing of being emo is to not want to be exactly. Helped out of it. Like, it's like to be relishing in the sadness, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is like amplified even more when other teens on these sites are bragging about hurting themselves. So it's not a great dynamic. Like goths, emos were also quite maligned among normie populations. It was common for people to, you know, go into these online spaces and troll emos or like cyberbully them. And this wasn't helped by the fact that all of the major bands were like refusing to associate themselves with the movement. Like Mikey Way, who's the bassist for My Chemical Romance and also Gerard's brother, said that like the band was at odds with the term emo. And he was like, we did everything we could, kicking and screaming to get away from it. Gerard Way famously called it a pile of shit. So I think the hate coming from outside kind of creates an us against the world's self-annihilating mentality within a subculture that's already predisposed towards that thinking, I guess. So this led to a lot of panic among parents that kids on these sites were going to kick off some sort of like mass suicide pact. Does this remind you at all of the copycat suicide panic that happened after Kurt Cobain died?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's completely reasonable when parents are scared about their kids doing something fucking stupid because the people around them have done something like it, because the people that they idolize might have done something like it or encouraged it or glorified it in some way. Like, and not that I, you know, obviously sometimes it can go into moral panic territory, but kids do insanely stupid things, and I don't think necessarily have a fully developed grasp of consequences or the kind of finality of death. And I think that it does remind me of that kind of thing.
Yeah, totally. I think it's fair for a parent to be like, ah, what is my kid involved in?
And also the internet was like,
in?
like, social media was so new, and parents, like, it's just such a foreign place, and you're like, you don't know who your kids are. Like, it's just like, it, so much new stuff to grapple with, and your kids being exposed, I guess, to new things.
Well, yeah, they're like, your kids are exposed to this whole world that you yourself aren't even exposed to. Like, you're not on MySpace, you're not seeing, well, like, what they're up to, so...
can even understand, because you don't really have any frame of reference for it because it wasn't there when you grew up. Whereas, like, now millennials with kids, it's like, well, they grew up with proximity to social media.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, the stranger danger era was definitely a big one at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's fair for parents to be on edge about that. Just even the most literal similarities, like, I think there are a lot of similarities also between Nirvana and emo bands of the 2000s. Not just because, like, emo bands owe a lot of their musical influence to the grunge era, but also... just this idea of, like, a band being kind of, like, dragged, kicking, and screaming into the mainstream definitely has a lot of striking similarity, especially a band that's kind of celebrated for its, like, moroseness, or, like, a really morose frontman who's something like a deity to his fans. But yeah, there was a lot of talk of suicide contagion from the articles around this period and from parents online. And this definitely can qualify as a moral panic, just because, you know, like, emos and the emo bands and the internet kind of became folk devils. Kind of this idea of, like, corrupting young children into suicidal ideation, when, like, the vast majority of the culture was still very much just, like, aesthetically and musically dominant.
Right.
And, you know, whenever you kind of use a cultural object as a scapegoat, you know, without really being critical about why so many kids are attracted to emo subculture, or, like, why your kids are depressed, you know, like, yeah. Their answers, well, like, suburban alienation, hormones, but people instead were like, it's the band's fault, you know?
It's also giving Marilyn Manson and Columbine.
Exactly. I would say, like, maybe a little silver lining to this is just, like, this was kind of the first time people were openly talking about mental health and depression so freely on the internet, and, like, obviously, maybe not in a great way, but it was kind of almost getting the ball rolling for being more open and honest about these things, you know? I also wonder, do you think, like, 9/11 or Y2K, not to pull this one, but do you think 9/11 or Y2K maybe had effects on these generations that made them, like, that kind of resulted in them forming these types of subcultures?
Have you heard the theory that, we have Twilight because of 9/11?
Oh, maybe vaguely, but talk about it. Let's hear it.
I think it was, like, 9/11 inspired Gerard Way to do, like, inspired something with My Chemical Romance, which inspired Twilight is, I think, either confirmed or theorized to be basically, like, fan fiction about, I think, like, some kind of emo performer. It might be Gerard Way or someone from My Chemical Romance. And Stephanie Meyer was, like, listening to all, like, kind of emo music while she was writing Twilight. So, like, obviously Twilight is so reminiscent of emo culture. And so through that, we, like, have Twilight because of 9/11. But,
whoa.
So, like, I mean... look, we can't measure all the ways that 9/11, like, shaped and impacted culture. And I mean, even pre-9/11, I think that suburban American youth have always kind of found ways to
lash out.
Yeah, and that, like, these sentiments have materialized in different forms, like, throughout history, through different musical genres. So, like, can we say it's specifically 9/11? No, but I think that... I don't know, like, I'd be interested to kind of track the trends of conservative presidents and sort of angry, disenfranchised white suburban youth music. That would be interesting.
Yeah. Could be fascinating. I know. Yeah, I found it really interesting in my research because My Chemical Romance was described, like, often as kind of offering an escape for people who came of age watching the Twin Towers fall. The cynicism in their lyrics allows people to kind of, like, laugh at their own pain. I also think there's kind of a fantastical element to them, too. Like, Black Parade has this really rock opera sound that kind of makes it feel almost, like, satirical sometimes. It's such a fucking good album. But, yeah, there's just, like, a general embrace of sadness and pain that, when it's not being, like, glorified, obviously... I think can also help young people, especially young men, get in touch with their emotions. Like, maybe this was kind of a subcultural response to mass trauma, but I don't know. Like, yeah, there's no way to really measure that.
I just feel like we're always trying to attribute, I think especially when it's, like, a sort of, like, male, like, a white male sadness, we're always trying to find some kind of political or, like, cultural reason for it, because we can never just accept that, like, that is a demographic that also, like, experiences these sad emotions, but just, like, has a weirder time grappling with them or expressing them, and that it sort of, like, manifests in these ways. But we're always trying to find some, like, greater significance for it, because, of course, the white male plight is, like, the absolute worst one out of all of them, and it must be because of something beyond their genuine, just, like, human emotions. I don't know.
I think the attribution might be sometimes a little bit of a reach. I'm sure there is some sort of watershed thing. You know, like, thinking about even Green Day, who in many ways are kind of akin to My Chemical Romance and came up with these bands, is such a, like, response to the Bush administration and such a, like, angry. Sure. And, like, they were so popular and a lot of their popularity came from that. So I think, in a way, yes. But they were making kind of, like, protest music in a way that I don't think emo bands were. Emo bands were pretty apolitical. Emo started to self-cannibalize quite a bit by the end of the decade. There was a lot of, like, gatekeeping and pointing fingers at so-called, like, posers, which is kind of classic for any alt subculture. But especially as emo aesthetics started to creep into malls and places like Hot Topic, there's a lot of infighting over authenticity. Some people said to be emo, you had to be depressive. So do you want to read this passage? It's from a girl named Sarah, and she wrote this in an emo forum.
Emo is short for emotional, so is there such a thing as a non-emotional emo? If a kid fits the emo image, e.g. wears skinny jeans, listens to My Chemical Romance, etc., but isn't emotional, then are they an emo, or are they just a kid who fits the image, but not the personality? In my opinion, I think if there's no emotion, then it's not emo. They're just emo posers.
Yeah, you gotta be depressa. There was also talk of people abandoning the music. There was this, like, classic graphic that was being circulated back then, like, early meme style, or it would be, like, a text post that people would just, like, spam in comment sections. I'll have you read this as well.
You win. You're more punk, hardcore, mod, straight edge, emo, indie than me. Your hair is cooler, your pants are tighter, you're skinnier and better looking, and have more tattoos. Your glasses are thicker and blacker than mine. The plugs in your ears are bigger. You know more people in bands, and your black jelly bracelets are the envy of scenesters everywhere. Your photography is blacker and whiter, your live journal profile is wittier, your scene points are double, perhaps triple mine. Because as we all know, that's what really matters. In a scene where the music has taken a backseat to the haircuts, you win and I lose. Congrats. Wow.
I just love the earnestness of this time. I also like to think that scene points are just like scene points that you get at Cineplex Odeon.
Oh my god. Canadian reference.
Congrats. You have more scene points than me.
Oh my god, I love collecting scene points. I do remember, and, like, I don't really necessarily remember it in context of, like, being seen, but even just the idea of, I think kids our age, even though if you asked, like, a Brooklyn hipster if they were a hipster, they'd be, like, really offended and, like, hate being called a hipster. When you were our age at that time, everyone wanted to be accused of being a hipster, and then they knew they had to go, oh my god, I'm not a hipster, because you can't admit you're a hipster, but you're, you, like, wanted to be. You're like, oh my god, I'm not a hipster, I just love wearing granny sweaters and combat boots. And so I did that a lot, and so that kind of reminds me of that, where it's like everyone is very much curating an image for themselves around, like, what they like, but, like, dressing that way. But then everyone wants to seem like they have the most authentic interest in the thing that they like, even though they're all participating in this kind of culture of it.
Part of me also wonders if there's, like, a division between the underage people in these groups and then, like, the overage people. Because I think, like, yeah, kids in high school would be like, stop, I'm not a hipster. But, like, actual, like, adults in their 20s probably don't want to be a part of... They're trying to just, like, live like that. Or they're, like, the originators of these aesthetics. And same as, like, older emo people. Like, yeah. I think, like, young people, you know, are acquiring these outfits from Hot Topic because that's, like, the only way they can. And so... It does feel like maybe the second that, like, underage people start to join your movement, you're like, ah.
No.
Or it's, like, not a movement, sure. and then young people make it a movement. Like, I don't know. It's interesting just thinking about the age divide, maybe.
Well, even, like, I hate when I, like a certain thing, and then I see it all at Urban Outfitters, and I'm like, oh, teenagers are wearing this now? Well, I can't wear it because I don't want to dress like a teenager.
Yeah, like, I think that might be part of the infighting as well.
Yeah.
And then the scene was getting criticized more and more for its exclusivity, particularly when it came to women and people of color. Like, of course, emo had introduced this new kind of masculinity because of its, like, vulnerable attitudes in its music. There were also themes of, like, bisexuality a lot during this time, or at least, like, sexual fluidity. Panic at the Disco has a song called Boys Will Be Boys, and one of the lines is, "Boys will be boys, hiding in estrogen and wearing aubergine dreams," which I think is interesting. But emo was still a boys' club. You know, most of its bands were all-male groups, and, you know, slowly it started to come out that sexual assault was kind of rampant in these circles, very akin to, like, our indie sleaze conversation, you know, presenting this alt-masculinity, which kind of, like, invites women and gets their guards down and then using that against them. The frontman for an emo group called Brand New, named Jesse Lacey, got Me Too'd in 2017 by numerous women, one of whom had been a minor. And Jacob Hogard from Headley was literally sent to prison for sexual assault in 2022, again involving a minor, but, like, actually so many women. I know Headley isn't explicitly emo at all. Like, it is a bit more just, like, rock, but definitely borrowed some of the aesthetics and was very much around in these scenes during this time. Maybe we don't consider them emo because they're Canadian.
But what about Mariana's Trench? That's emo.
That's what I was thinking about. I would say more scene than emo, but definitely, yeah, that pop punk. Like, Mariana's Trench was so derivative of Fall Out Boy. It's, like, actually crazy.
It's so funny.
Honestly, all these bands, they all have such similar kind of, like, really upbeat. I don't know how to describe it. Like, so many other rock subcultures, women were often the subjects of a lot of these songs, but generally treated like interlopers or, like, sexual objects. Just a classic vibe for any male-centric subculture.
This might be the really dumb question, but is Hey There, Delilah scene?
I think the pipeline from scene to twee is a really short pipeline. Like, the preciousness
That's so
of, like, these ukulele-centric songs. I think that there was a lot of overlap there. I think that they were almost contemporaries with each other. So, yeah, probably here at the Hey There, Delilah, those guys probably definitely had deep side parts, spiky.
So then I'm going to say that, like, in this pendulum between, like, twee and scene, I guess I was just on the twee side.
She found her place. This episode is actually about figuring out where Hannah fits.
I was listening to She and Him before they started playing their songs on TikTok because my dad had a crush on Zooey Deschanel.
On TikTok?
Yeah, She and Him, because when they were like, twee's coming back, and then it didn't.
Oh, well, yeah, I was listening to She and Him back in the 2010s when they were a thing.
But of course. Wait, what? I don't know. I was like, all these teens playing She and Him, but then I was like, I guess it's not really underground. It's literally Zooey Deschanel's band.
No, it's pretty. Yeah, and I would say it's a bit later than
But it's
scene.
Twee.
Like, I think it came out of Scene, but I think Twee is later than Scene. If you guys hear a whizzing noise, it's my crazy New York radiator, so please bear with me. So, as I've hinted at, emo ends up selling out, as some would put it. Almost simultaneously, like, the garb and the music became really mainstream. Hot Topic became a massive thing. And you could see the fashion slowly creep into more normie stores as well. And like you're saying, you know, Vanessa Hudgens with the spiky side bangs. Like, that is still diluted version of these, like, haircuts that came before it. The emo trinity were so big that every major record label kind of wanted their own My Chemical Romance or Fall Out Boy, and it just got really oversaturated and diluted. You had a lot of bands coming out of nowhere that were just clearly trying to cash in on a moment. In the Dan Oatsy book, he interviews Blake Schwarzenbach from Jawbreaker, and Schwarzenbach essentially talks about how much the newer bands had deviated from the earlier days. He's like, "I don't like the boy-centric stuff that was really ubiquitous after us, and with which we were constantly associated. That wasn't what we were doing. We weren't from the suburbs. We were an urban band from New York and San Francisco and LA, and we sang about urban alienation. It wasn't about, hey, my mom's out of town, come over, like Newfound Glory and these fucking bands. I totally don't like those people personally. I just like the personalities behind that music." I'm like, okay.
I love when people talk shit like that.
A snarky ass bitch, yeah.
Yeah.
But I love it, because I love when people are snarky, but they deserve to be.
Like, I'm your elder, you're a little bitch. I love it.
I was reading this quote from Orson Welles about Woody Allen, and it's so fucking good. It's so cutting. My friend had shown it to me. I'll read it to you after, but it's honestly so accurate. And I'm like, yeah, Orson Welles can afford to be such a fucking bitch during his time, because it's like, yeah, he earned his stripes to be a snarky little asshole, and I love it, and he's right. Jawbreaker's producer also fired shots at Fall Out Boy and Panic for mimicking Jawbreaker, which I can't really, like, attest to that, but he said that he actually respected My Chemical Romance, which I kind of agree. I think My Chemical Romance is just, to me, a little more elevated than the other two bands. I think that what they're doing is genuinely really amazing.
Well, can I be honest? I actually don't know a single My Chemical Romance song. Like, I know that one Panic at the Disco song, and I know that Fall Out Boy song. I don't know My Chemical Romance, so maybe that means they're the real deal, because, like, basic bitches like me don't know them.
Yeah, I think that they were a little, they maintained their alt status a little bit more, I would say. I'm literally going to send you this one song so you can listen to the very beginning of it. Because it's amazing and you must know. I should have sent you these for homework.
Oh my god, I'm going to make you listen to 20-minute long Grateful Dead live recordings for research.
I've listened to the Grateful Dead, babe.
I'm going to make you listen to more. And it's going to take years out of your life. Am I listening now?
Did you get it? Oh, I sent it in the chat. I'm forcing Hannah right now to listen to Helena by My Chemical Romance because I should have given her homework to do and I didn't.
But also, like, I should have just, like, known my Chemical Romance.
Well, yeah, we can start with that.
Ew.
Hannah does not belong in this episode. She must go.
I feel like maybe I've seen this music video somewhere, but maybe I actually don't know. Maybe I'm confusing it with the one from Panic at the Disco.
Probably. It is a little insane that you've never heard one of their songs.
He looks so scary. Like, Pete once was at least hot.
You're being a hater. Who wants to replace okay. Hannah in this episode? She's not allowed.
I'm so sorry. I know this must be so annoying for people who are like, yeah, I know all about emo and scene and having to listen to me talk.
So crazy. I know I talked about how the internet is, you know, micromedia and it can be a great place for subcultures. But do you think to a degree emo selling out was also almost inevitable once it reached the internet?
Well, yeah, but it's also like, again, punk sold out, grunge sold out. All of these things that come from like some sort of an organic beginning that like initially speak to people who feel alternative or who feel like they're, you know, not in the mainstream. Yes, like, obviously, once it hit the internet, it probably sold out at, like, a faster rate. But once somebody's tapped into what the youth want, and then that thing becomes popular, like, it's just inevitable. Like, not, like, if enough young people like something, it just can't stay authentic or underground for very long. But obviously, like, since this happened, like, I think it happens a lot faster. It's, like, a much quicker turnaround with the internet. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Like, definitely the internet ruins everything.
Yeah, I also think, like, everyone's inner self being their persona in these spaces on the internet kind of made it, like, easy for emo subculture to want to be a part of. And, like, there is just this universality in being sad, you know? Yeah. Like, they talked about, like, oh, the universality of Jawbreaker's lyrics. It's like, yeah, everyone feels sadness. Everyone experiences it. A lot of people have depression. So there was kind of something in emo culture for everyone to a degree. Off what you were saying, I have this video about Tim Burton where I talk about how, you know, Tim Burton's whole outsider shtick started to get kind of tired and inauthentic when his movies became blockbusters. Like, to a point you just can't keep whining about how no one likes you when that's just, like, categorically untrue. And I think a similar thing happened to emo, which I also think Burton helped to drive into the ground. Hot Topic.
Oh my god.
Ass bitch. Yeah.
The fucking Alice in Wonderland live action movie and, like, soundtrack with, like, Avril Lavigne. Like,
It was like late stage Avril Lavigne too. Ooh.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think definitely also it's like such an aesthetically realized like kind of subculture. Like it's one that has a very clear aesthetic vision and like so many aesthetic signifiers, but they're also not that like hard to recreate. And like I was wearing things that were emo pieces without even knowing that they were emo or scene. Because I was just shopping at mall stores. Mm. I was wearing my houndstooth, like, checkered kind of scarf and then graphic tees and colored skinny jeans and, like, had a side bangs. And I didn't even know that that was seen. I just thought that that was fashion.
Well, yeah, something just gets decontextualized so quickly when it gets absorbed into mainstream culture. I think the internet definitely escalates those kinds of things. Like, you know, having people be fans of bands before an album even comes out. It's like, yeah, well, it's not really about the music at that point. You're a fan of like the boys in the band, you know, and that's great. And that has been around for a long time as well. But I think it's easy for the musical element to kind of go away once a subculture reaches these spaces where also other things are equal priority.
Right.
Alas. So, okay, if we were to think of 9/11, let's say, being this like watershed thing that maybe gives way to a subculture, if we were to think about it from that lens, with all the like insane watershed shit happening right now, I won't even list it out because you all know. Do you think we'll see a similar type of youth movement appear today? Like, do you think emo could exist today? Do you think it's already happened?
I fucking hope so, because the alternative is these fucking men becoming more and more conservative by the minute. Okay, I complain about men who like make their emotions the most important thing in the room, because I think that men prioritize. I think that white men think that when they feel something, they're feeling it more than any other person does, because they're not taught to like normalize those feelings, I suppose. And so I find them insufferable a lot of the time, but I would rather a bunch of whiny bisexuals than fucking incels and school shooters. So yeah, I really do hope that something like emo comes up again.
I agree. I'll take a bisexual coated guyliner misogynist light kind of guy over just like, yeah, an Andrew Tate lover any day.
Yeah, read me your bad poetry, babe. Just don't take away my rights. Like,
yeah, I'd honestly way rather go back to indie sleaze misogyny than whatever the fuck is happening now. I agree also, yeah, it's like, whenever white men are sad, they're like, it is an epidemic. And it's like, okay. Yeah.
And it's like, okay, right. Just like women are, you know, used to feeling earth-crushing pain monthly when they get period cramps. We're like, yeah, I'm feeling like unbelievably depressed today, but it's like I have to actually get on with my life. So, well, sorry, like, I'm feeling I'm giving misandrist.
Yeah, what the hell, Hannah? Yeah, someone's gonna get in these comments and like read me some stats or whatever, and I'm gonna say I have all the talking points to argue against that, but I don't have the energy in this episode to do so. But yeah, it's hard for me to tell what would be an authentic resurgence of emo, mainly just because, you know, its main players rejected the title so much. But also, anytime emo also reappears in culture, it kind of feels like it's coming out of that 20-year nostalgia cycle and not, like, a movement in its own right.
It's just, like, boys on TikTok who paint their nails who are, like, lip-syncing to emo songs, but it's not,
the
e-boys. Like, yeah, who are, you know, I don't think they would have necessarily been emos in their day because they're, like, conventionally hot kind of cool guys.
Yeah, they're not like loser boys. Yeah. There are a lot of clear influences from emo artists today, like, you know, Olivia Rodrigo so closely emulating Paramore, the whole Lil Peep phenomenon, and like all those hip hop artists kind of merging with like alt rock sounds and aesthetics. There's like that Princess Nokia mixtape. But again, it's just hard to tell if it's because these artists grew up with emo and now it's like en vogue again, or if it's coming from like a distinct feeling. And I couldn't tell you, like, I don't know, maybe Trump has inspired little emos everywhere. But I'm like, I would like to see like something completely different from emo, but with a similar thrust come about. And I'm fascinated to know if that's about to happen with like middle schoolers, you know? Like, I don't know.
If there are any middle schoolers listening, tell us, how do you deal with your pain?
My niece does watch Demon Slayer, and I feel like that is certainly morose enough. Thank you.